Franz Schubert just starting to come into his own as a composer with his Symphony No. 6. Claudio Abbado led the Chamber Orchestra of Europe.
89.3 FM, WHFR, Dearborn. That's the station that you're listening to, and we're so glad you're there. Good day. I'm Susan McGraw, WHFR General Manager. It is a pleasure to welcome you to our airwaves. If you've got a business or an organization and you would like to get the word out in a more in-depth way, particularly during these challenging economic times, well, WHFR underwriting or sponsorship might just be the thing for you. It is a very, very cost-effective way to get the word out about your business or organization to wonderful listeners. Listeners that support the independent alternative programming here at WHFR and are very loyal and very receptive to what we do. If you'd like to learn more about how cost-effective underwriting can be and how it truly supports this station here at WHFR, we would love to talk with you. Give me a call, 313-845-9842. That's 313-845-9842.
This is WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves. I'm Jay Koronek, station advisor. Today's WHFR Forum, by special arrangement, is the July 7th edition of This Week in Science, a weekly talk news show produced by and broadcast on KDVS-FM at the University of California, Davis. The creator host is Dr. Kirsten Sanford, and her co-host is Justin Jackson. The topic of this show is evolution, and their special guest is Dr. Tim Coulson of the Imperial College London. If you like This Week in Science and would like to hear each of their shows regularly on WHFR, please let us know by sending an email to whfr@hfcc.edu.
It's an illusion, constructed out of observation and often crafted by our parents, teachers, friends, and in the current age, by a media full of messages. Our personal illusion of the world is always filtered through some combination of these influences. One of the wonderful things about science is that it is the only mode of thinking that seeks to ignore that personal world, to reject our illusions, and force the mind to look at information each time as if the real world were brand new and in need of introduction. This way of seeing without assumption of knowing can make visible in a glance that which would have remained invisible to the filtered eye. A glance at Hubble's data plot, revealing an expanding universe. A glance at Fleming's bacterial dish, ushering in the age of antibiotics. A glance at patterns across a flickering screen, signaling that a cosmic discovery, a genetic breakthrough, or a needed cure is on the way, one step closer, or at least within our reach. And while the world without science remains illusionary at best, it, like the Falling Hour programming, still does not represent the views or opinions of the University of California, Davis, KDVS, or its sponsors. Yet we will continue with wide-eyed introductions to reality, continue glancing over steady streams of data as it flows past our radio vision, seeking that data plot, that oddly dotted dish, that flickering signal from an illusion-free world of This Week in Science, coming up next.
I've got the kind of mind that can't get enough. I want to learn everything. I want to fill it all up with new discoveries that happen every day. I want to know what's happening, what's happening, what's happening this week in science. What's happening, what's happening, what's happening this week in science.
Good morning, Kirsten.
Good morning, Justin. We have a great show ahead. This is This Week in Science, and it's a very special episode of me kicking buckets under the table.
Yeah, see, that's normally where my shins are. Today I've got bucket guard, large plastic bucket between me and Kirsten, just in case I get kicked.
That's great. Well, no, we actually are going to be talking about evolution the entire hour. That's what this show is going to be dedicated to. We're dedicating it to understanding what is understood about the wily ways of evolution. And our guest for the entire hour is Dr. Tim Coulson from University College London, who just last week published a paper in the journal Science on the environmental selection of shrinking sheep in Scotland. And so hopefully he's going to set us straight. According to his website, Dr. Coulson is a population biologist who studies how demographic rates vary across groups of individuals and environments and identifies the ecological and evolutionary consequences of this variation. Hopefully today he will be able to elucidate some of the evolutionary details about which Justin and I have been debating for the last 2 weeks. And so without any further ado, let's bring him on the line. You want to hit the button?
Oh.
Hit the little green button? Dr. Coulson, are you here with us?
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to This Week in Science.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. We're very excited to have you here, or at least on the phone, and kind of we're going to talk about the newsy aspects of your sheep publication in Science, and we're going to then dig deep into the details of evolution with your assistance. Let's see. We can start with the news of the week, which is your story.
Yeah.
And to make the story short, you're blaming climate change for shrinking some sheep. You know, like you put the sheep in the dryer too long.
Yeah, is it the added heat to the moist Scottish tundra that's shrinking them? What's happening here?
So what we found is over the course of our study, winters have got shorter as our measure of the climate, the North Atlantic Oscillation, has changed with time. And what this has meant is that spring, as is occurring through much of the Northern Hemisphere, is actually arriving a little bit earlier than it used to. And a consequence of this means that many of the smaller, slower-growing sheep that in the past, when winters were a little bit longer and a little bit harsher, these animals would have used to have keeled over and died by the end of the winter. Many of these are now surviving. And this has had two consequences. This has brought the average size of the sheep in the population down a little bit. So the average sheep is now smaller than it was about a quarter of a century ago by about 5%. But also the population has actually increased as conditions on the island have actually got a little bit better.
So, yeah, the shorter winter, there's longer feeding time. There's more stuff growing, right?
That's right. There's a slightly longer period when the grass is growing, but there's also a period when the period when the grass isn't growing is consequently also a little bit shorter. Now, a lot of people immediately say, well, wait a second, there's more grass. Wouldn't you expect larger sheep? But no, more grass has actually meant more sheep, but also has meant that some of the smaller, slowing growing ones are surviving.
And this is on an island, but this isn't where we wouldn't call this island like a island dwarfism effect at this point.
Not at this point, no. So this is on an island. It's a group of the St. Kilda Archipelago is a group of islands about 80 miles off the west coast of Scotland, and we studied them on the largest island, an island called Herta. Now sheep have been on the archipelago of islands for between 3,000 and 4,000 years, and they're thought to be very closely domesticated to, very closely related to the sheep that were initially domesticated by mankind. And as far as we're aware, certainly for, since historical records were written down, whilst people lived on the island, people left in 1930, these sheep have essentially been unmanaged. Now, we don't believe this is a sort of classic case of island dwarfism that has been seen in things like elephants and rhinos on some of the Mediterranean islands. And then, in fact, that dwarfism took much longer than we're talking about now. For example, the decline, or the majority of the decline in things like elephants on the Mediterranean islands took well over 100,000 years.
Hmm. And what do you think the factors are? What do people think the factors are for this, the island dwarfism that would not necessarily be the same as what you're witnessing in Scotland?
It's entirely possible that the processes that we've actually been able to describe, identify and to work out their contributions of are the same sorts of processes that lead to change in body size on islands, especially when you arrive in a simple system where there is little competition for food from other species and there's no predation. It's entirely possible that that changes in the way that competition food occurs, as we've actually been reporting, as I've been describing there. In this case, it's been caused by shortening winters. But it's entirely possible that changes due to animals being isolated away from competitor species, so into specific competition, and from predators could result in similar effects. We just don't know at the moment. But the reason we study the sheep on this island in the middle of nowhere, way off Scotland, is because it's almost like a natural laboratory. It's a very, very simple system. Sheep are the only large vertebrates on the island. They're the only large herbivores on the island. So we have a remarkably simple system consisting of sheep and vegetation. So if we can't understand the ecological and the evolutionary dynamics on this island in this very simple system, we're going to have little chance in more complicated cases where there are many species coexisting, predators, etc.
Right.
The good news is we've actually made reasonably good progress in understanding what's going on in the system, not just in terms of the body size, but also in terms of animal behavior, in terms of the population dynamics, etc.
Yeah. So, what are some of the animal behaviors and dynamics that are going on there that could, that potentially lead into this difference in what you've been seeing over the last quarter century?
So, in terms of the population dynamics that we see. One of the reasons this island started is the dynamics are relatively unusual for a large mammal. The population fluctuates quite substantially over time, and every between 3 and 5 or 6 years, there's quite a large population crash when up to 60 or 70% of individuals die. Now, the severity of these crashes does change from time to time. And in fact, we haven't seen a large die-off in the last few years. We keep predicting one, but one hasn't occurred recently. But one of the things that's happened dynamically over the course of time is, and I kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier, as the winter length has shortened and conditions during the winter have actually improved, this means that more smaller, slower-growing individuals are surviving, which actually corresponds to a decrease in selection pressure. So natural selection has actually decreased over time in this study. And the selection typically favors big sheep, but the selection for bigger sheep has actually declined a little bit over time. Now, one of the other things that we did in this paper, rather than explain why the sheep are shrinking, we also were able to explain why this positive selection, which one would traditionally have expected to lead to an increase in body size, wasn't realized.
I think that's really interesting. The language that's used to describe, you talk about this positive selection pressure or having it be removed. Whereas, the way I was envisioning it is that it's all natural selection. It's just a change in, a change in the environment has just shifted the emphasis of the selection pressure. I mean, is that just a difference in the way of interpretation, or is it, what am I thinking wrong?
So the way that ecologists and evolutionary biologists can report the strength of selection is using something called a selection differential. And what this really just tells you is the difference between, if we're looking at survival selection, so in this case, whether a large or small animals are more or less likely to survive, is what a selection differential does. It tells you the difference in the trait value between surviving individuals and the entire population before selection occurs. So it's something that's actually quite easy to measure if you've got enough data and the data are good. And one of the things we were able to do is actually characterize, so in our breakdown of all the factors that contribute to a change in body size, we were actually able to measure accurately and unbiased manner the strength of these selection differentials. And it's very clear that these selection differentials have declined over time. So an environmental change has just altered the way that the strength of the selection differentials, it's still there, selection is still occurring, but it's just operating in a slightly different way and slightly less strongly than it was before. Now, we've also, as you say, had a shift in the growth rates. It's entirely possible that the shift in the growth rates with more smaller, slower-growing animals surviving has a genetic underpinning, in which case is subject to evolutionary change itself. We haven't actually done the quantitative genetic methods on the growth rate per se. However, we have done it on total body size, so absolute body size. We find that absolute body size is partially determined by genes. Mm-hmm. So given the fact that we've seen a change in the selection pressure on a trait that we know is influenced partly on genes, what we've found is that climate change or the changing environment is actually influencing the way that evolution is occurring.
So it is having an effect on the allele, the gene frequency in the population?
That's right. It will be having an effect on the allele frequencies. Now, we're starting to get with colleagues at Sheffield and Edinburgh, we're starting to get an understanding a little bit about the actual genes, so the actual loci, genetic loci associated with body size. However, we don't know, body size is really quite a complicated character, quite a complicated trait, and there are many, many genes involved. And what biologists tend to do in the case like this, when there are many genes involved, is you try and make an inference about how important genes are overall without identifying the specific loci. And the way you do this is you look to see whether related individuals, i.e. parents of their offspring or cousins, are more similar for the character or the trait you're looking at than unrelated individuals. So although we haven't been able to specifically prove there's been a change in gene frequency, mm-hmm. what we are able to do is to work out that there is what's known as a heritability of the trait, which we identify by comparing whether body size is more similar amongst related individuals than it is amongst individuals that are not so closely related. We are able to then come up with a number between 0 and 1, which tells us how much, so what proportion of the trait is due to genes. And a value of 0, heritability of 0, would tell us that the trait, i.e. body size in this case, is entirely determined by the environment, while a value of 1 would tell us it's entirely determined by genes. What we find in the case of body size is a value of between 0.1 and 0.2, it depends how you do the calculations, which tell us that 10 to 20% of your body size, so how big you grow to, is determined by genes, whilst the rest is determined by environmental conditions, be those environmental conditions in utero when you're developing as a lamb, or once you've been born and as you're growing during the juvenile stage.
So there was somebody in there was a popular science write-up in Science Magazine on their Science Now website, and they found an ecologist, Malcolm Gordon, from the University of California, Los Angeles, who praised your study.
That's
very nice of him. But he says other mechanisms may be at work, and the quote that they have from him is that he says, changing environmental conditions on the island may have led to changes in the chemical composition and nutritional value of the plant foods the sheep eat, and that may have shrunk the sheep. But, you know, he says at the end of the day, climate change could still be the root cause. I mean, is he on track, or, you know, how do you respond to that kind of a critique?
So in order to answer that, I'll just take a sort of small step back. So the approach that we did was we essentially started by saying, well, these sheep have been getting a little bit smaller, but there is selection, and, you know, even though it's relatively weak, there is selection for sheep to get bigger. So why isn't this occurring? So technically, what we did was the following. We sat down and we said, what are the processes that could actually lead to change in the size of the average sheep over time, over from 1 year to the next, over a time step? And it turns out there's this thing called viability selection, which is selection due to large animals having a better survival chance than small animals. Mm-hmm. There's fertility selection, which means bigger animals might be able to produce more offspring or might be more likely to reproduce than smaller animals. There's then growth rates of individual animals that survive, so the average growth rate amongst survivors. There's a difference between offspring and their parents in terms of their body size. And then there's just changes in the population structure, which, again, is almost like a nuisance variable we need to tease apart. Now, what we were able to find is, as I've already mentioned this, that selection has weakened. So the strength of natural selection is a little less strong than it used to be. However, that was still pushing for sheep to get a little bit bigger. Now, the reason they weren't getting bigger in the first instance was because when we looked to see the difference between the trait of offspring and their mothers, we found that there was a process that meant there were always small sheep being born into the population. And this process of small sheep being born into the population is caused by young mothers that are breeding for the first time are just incapable of producing large, heavy lambs themselves. And this is probably because the mothers haven't bred before. They're not necessarily, well, they're not fully grown. They haven't reached their body size. But those effects weren't enough to explain the decrease in size. They were enough to explain stasis in size, so why the sheep hadn't been getting bigger. Now, they've been getting smaller because of this growth rate effect that I've described before. Now, each of these processes that I've just described add up perfectly to tell you the change in average body size. And what we did is we applied this equation for each year of our study, so each of the 25 years we've been studying these animals. And then we found there was a decline in growth rate. So then what we did was a statistical analysis of the growth rate from year to year. And we were able to find that the population density, so the number of animals on the island, and winter weather, as I've already described, influenced this growth rate. Now, we've got a fairly, you know, we then teased this out a little bit more and came to the conclusions that this effect is the winter's getting a little bit shorter and sheep growing a little bit more slowly. Now, because this part of the analysis is a statistical analysis, and it's not an exact description there, there are potentially other factors that could be involved in this process that we haven't been able to measure, we haven't been able to characterize. And of course, it's entirely possible that, you know, we have missed something, and one of those things we could have missed may well have been the fact that changing grazing pressures has led to a change in the secondary plant compounds, i.e. some plants are a little bit harder to digest given the changes in the growing season. That's a really interesting and, an insightful comment, and it's something that hopefully we'll be able to address in the future. But certainly from the analyses that we have done now, we're fairly confident that one of the roles that's coming out as important is that the change in the length of the growing season means that smaller animals are actually able, slower-growing animals are able to survive. And we're fairly confident that's true, but we're not in a position to actually rule out any other processes as being important. So I think it's a great comment and one that we're almost certainly going to follow up on in the future.
And you've mentioned population density and how people are have been sort of predicting the crash. Yeah. Is the population really high right now for the sheep on the island? Are they?
Yeah, the population's probably as high as it's ever been. Okay. And as I said, as the sheep have got smaller, the total numbers, on average, it does jump around a lot, as I've already said, but the total numbers have been going up. And in fact, we're predicting at the moment that this year we're probably going to see more sheep on the island than we have since we've been studying them.
So are the sheep overall getting less grass to eat? Even though there's more being grown?
I expect that each sheep, because there's these two processes going on, the growing season has increased in length, sheep have got a little bit smaller, but the total number of sheep have increased. I suspect the amount of grass per kilogram of sheep has remained approximately constant, but it's the timing that's changed and the strength of selection.
It's fascinating. If you just tuned in, you're listening to This Week in Science with Dr. Kirsten Sanford and Justin Jackson. And so this story is, I think, really interesting, and listening to all of the different pressures, the different selection, you know, environmental, natural, growth rate, all these various pressures that go into determining the population and traits that the population have, kind of go back to the crux of this debate that Justin and I have been having for the last couple of weeks about how evolution works. And in the last couple of weeks, Justin has been arguing for what seems to be a very Lamarckian,
view
of evolution. <It's not. laughs> And at one point, you almost came across it supporting like some kind of intelligence behind evolution. You were going at there.
Yeah, I think it isn't. It. I think it's a. I think life is a very intelligent system. Not intelligently
is,
designed.
Right.
Or,
no,
you know,
I know.
Not intelligent creator. But
I'm giving
life
you.
Life is smart.
I'm giving you a hard time.
Life is clever. How about that?
It's a clever
setup.
It's clever. Lamarck, historical background. Lamarck proposed sometime before Darwin that gradual change during an organism's lifetime might be passed on to their offspring. Mm-hmm. But he was never able to propose a mechanism that was suitable for that process to actually explain it, and it fell out of favor. And it's been out of favor for a really long time. Darwin came around, proposed this process of natural selection, the gradual change on kind of a generational time scale that was supported later by Mendel and then the discovery of DNA. And since we've elucidated more aspects of evolutionary theory, the crux of the concept remains that evolution is based on the genetic information that's available, and it's driven by mutations. Natural selection acts on the phenotype, or kind of what the organisms look like, and you know, it's kind of like the phenotype is like the user interface for a piece of software. And then the code is like the DNA. So the phenotype is like the output of the genes. And so if a mutation in the genes doesn't make the user interface unusable, things work fine and you're able to still make things work. But when a mutation breaks that interface between the organism and the environment, the organism's not going to survive to be able to pass on that broken gene, and then the environment chooses the winner, survival of the fittest. And so I'd like to argue that it's possible for there to be other instructions present that can be passed on to the next generation that alter the way the genes are read and turned into output.
But that's my argument.
But the bottom line...
You can't take my argument and your argument. That's not fair.
The bottom line to what is possible is always going to be the genes. It's always going to be the genes.
No, it's not always going to be the genes.
And when you start using epigenetics as like this, you know, catch-all explanation, it's a just-so story, and it just loses...
What's a just-so story?
Well, it's just so.
I think we have to go back to the Marx Brothers movie, Day at the Races, and we have to go to the Tutti Frutti ice cream scene. You have no idea what I'm talking about.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't watch things that are in black and white.
Basically, Groucho Marx goes to bet on a horse, and he gets a, psst, hey, you want it? You want to know who's going to win? I got the book. And so he gets the book on who's going to win, and he looks at it, and it's in code. It looks like DNA code, in fact. It's just a series of letters. What's this? Oh, you need the code book to go with that book. And so he gets the code book, and he's got the code book, but then he needs the breeder's book to go with the code book. That's kind of where I think we are with DNA. DNA has turned out not to be the blueprint. It's turned out to be much too simple to explain everything that's going on. And we thought we would get this code, and we'd be able to troubleshoot. We'd be able to pinpoint diseases and just see where the things are going wrong and know what needs to be monkeyed with. But we don't. We're looking at it and we're finding that the same gene discrepancies in different individuals can show up as manifest as different, completely different diseases. We're seeing that that creatures that have, what was the example recently? They cloned cats. They cloned a cat, and the cloned cat had a different coat than the original. Or they've had flies that they found that if they incubate at different temperatures, the fly's eyes color changes. And the eye color change from having been incubated at a different temperature is passed on to later generations. So there is something beyond simply the genes. The genes are not enough to explain. There's certainly ways of turning them on and off, but I think there's also effects of the genes that are translated differently based on the environment. I think the environment is a much bigger factor than it's been given credit for.
All right. Dr. Coulson, after listening to our two disparate, well, kind of, I guess, yeah, mostly disparate points of view.
You hedged yours. I didn't. I stuck to my guns. You're like, oh, well, maybe everybody's right. We can all be friends.
Do you have any comments about the points of view that we've both brought up?
Well, so I guess my take on this would be, first of all, we need to have a good definition of what we mean by evolution. And I think the working definition that most... population geneticists or evolutionary biologists would be is that evolution is measured by a change in allele frequencies. So you see a shift in allele frequencies over time. Now, that change in allele frequencies is caused by selection, and of course new alleles are brought into the population through mutation. Now, a lot of what you guys have been arguing about there is as how you go from those genes to the phenotype. And that's a really difficult question, and it's a question a lot of work's been done on at the moment. And one thing that is really clear is that we don't have this really simple map that goes from your genotype through to your phenotype. So the sort of map, i.e. the set of how you get from the genotype to the phenotype, is really rather difficult and it's really rather hard. And there's all sorts of additional drivers that can come in there and influence that mapping. So that's going to be things like the environment. But when we say the environment, it's kind of a catch-all for a huge number of different things. So that environment could be the environment that you've experienced when you're growing. It might be the environment you experience now. It might even be the environment that you experience when you are in gestation, in the womb, etc. And that environment may well be influenced by your what your mother did and what your mother experienced. And we also know that some of these interactions appear to be remarkably complicated because some genes can then be switched on or switched off as a function of that environment. So you can get these epigenetic effects going from one generation to the next. And what, in order to understand, so your spot on selection operates on the phenotype. That's what selection sees. So it sees your body size. It sees how good you are at fighting disease. It sees all of these sorts of things. And selection operates there, and whether you survive or whether you reproduce determines whether you pass on your genes, etc. But because the map between the genotype and the phenotype is so complicated, it's often really rather difficult to actually just look at the phenotype and look at selection and to be able to say how that's going to change allele frequencies. And then, of course, on top of that, we've got the whole process of mutations and how mutations occur, whether they occur in some parts of the genotype more preferentially than other parts, in terms of how the DNA is actually repaired by DNA repair mechanisms. So I hate to sound as though I'm coming down in the middle there, but I suspect you're both right. But my viewpoint would be, let's kind of start from a sensible definition of evolution. I think changes in allele frequencies is good. Adaptive evolution, so adaptive changes caused by selection. Yes, you can get evolution by drift, just demographic chance effects and what have you. But then actually going from selection on the phenotype to the changes at the genetic level is really quite hard because the map between genotype and phenotype can be so complicated. It can be influenced by the environment, and the environment is this multidimensional, many-faceted, and hard-to-measure thing that's out there.
All right. Well, on that note, knowing that I'm right and Justin's right, we are going to take a very short break. We will be back in just a couple of moments. This is This Week in Science. Dr. Coulson, please stay on the line because we have much more to discuss with you when we come back after the break.
Will do.
Thank you.
Patience are the only things I need. Put on a pair of goggles and go looking for the things I couldn't see.
If you're enjoying today's show, if you learned something new, or if you would just like to support our attempt at infotaining you, feel free to donate to the podcast by visiting www.twis.org and clicking on the donate button. Donations of any size are always welcome. Thank you for listening.
Deduces the proper percentage of X in your brain. This miracle cure leaves no permanent pain. And still,
you can't believe what a skeptic I am. I can't believe you believe in that plan. We disagree, but I still give a damn.
So I says, Lamarck is definitely the father of evolution. And the guy turns to me and he starts swinging and, oh, we're back. Oh, wait.
Welcome back. This is This Week in Science. And we are on the phone with Dr. Tim Coulson from the University College of London. Imperial College of London. I'm sorry. I got it wrong. Yes, and we are back and we've been having just a wonderful discussion. If you just joined us, Justin and I are both right in our own ways. Hopefully we will find a way to meet in the middle, knowing that we both have some aspect of correctness. Let's kind of get back to the nuts and the bolts of evolutionary theory. We mentioned Lamarck, and I mentioned Lamarck and Mendel and Darwin. I mean, is there anything that you think historically is important to the understanding of how we've gotten to where we are in our understanding of evolutionary theory?
Well, I think there's a huge amount. I mean, you've started with obviously the right names there,
right?
But I think one of the one of the most important things that has happened over the years is as the verbal theories of of Darwin have actually been expanded, and we've been able to write down equations that describe what's going on. We've been able to measure the force of adaptive evolution, and that's as I mentioned before, that's selection. We can measure that occurring. We've also been able to, the huge advances that have occurred in terms of genotyping individuals and being able to work out levels of genetic, how individuals differ. So, you need, for evolution to occur, you need genetic differences between individuals and you need selection. We've been able to prove both of those things. So we've got to a point now, as you know, where evolution is proven. It's not a theory. It's a proof. It's actually out there. And now we're really starting to be able to get to grips with putting the nuts and bolts on the serious complexities that arise behind it. And at the moment, many of those complexities are going from genotype to phenotype. So I believe there's been a huge body of evidence that has built up over the past few decades that really helps us get a much, much clearer understanding of how evolution works, how it's led to the diversity of life we see at the moment. And we're starting to get an idea of how our actions on the natural world may well be influencing the way evolution may occur in the future. What I expect will happen over the coming decades is we'll get to a point where we're able to make evolution into a more predictable science than it is currently. But in order to do that, though, we are going to need to understand this link between the genotype and the phenotype, which is what we were discussing before the break.
Right, and it is that mapping that's currently the point of complexity.
Absolutely. It's understanding. So we know that genes may well play a part in many aspects of the phenotypic, of the phenotype. So, it may well play a part in many of the things you can measure in individuals, be that those things behavior, be they, personality, be they body size and body shape, be their ability to fight diseases, you name it. People are identifying genes associated with these traits. The question now is, how do you go from the gene to the phenotype?
Yeah, and it's actually one of my favorite studies is the Trett Fox study, where they were breeding over I think 50 years or so, breeding foxes based on temperament. They were sort of doing an experiment to see if they could domesticate a wild fox.
Right.
And as they were doing this, just based on the temperament, just based on which ones could be friendlier towards the humans over successive generations, they noticed the coats were lightening on the ones that they had been selecting out. And it turns out they discovered the link between temperament, between stress levels, hormones, and the expression in the coat, and even in skull shape. There's even skull and some tail and ear shape differences that have been taking place over the generations, which is really an expression of stress in utero of the fox mothers, right? But I think it's very interesting that we're finally now making these connections between them.
I think that's right. And I think one of the points that you bring up there is an interesting one, is that often there's correlations between different traits. So in the case of the fox, it appears that temperament is genetically correlated or certainly in some way linked to coat color. Now, whether that's actually through genes that are linked together, genes that determine temperament and genes that determine coat color are close together on a chromosome, or whether it's through hormone levels, which in themselves may be influenced by genes that then go through to influence, and the hormone levels influence temperament and coat color, I'm not sure. But I think it's that sort of level of complexity that we're now starting to get a grip of and are now starting to understand.
That gets into the question of these kind of maternal effects and how things like what happens, what the mothers eat, what the hormone levels are like, how that affects the offspring. Is there any recognized paternal effect that anything that happens to the sperm before it gets to the point of conception and
yes.
gestation?
So in most of the maternal effects, well, you can split maternal effects into kind of two classes. There's what's known as maternal environment effects, which come from the environment in utero, and there's maternal genetic effects that come from the genetic composition of the egg. Now, there will also be paternal there'll be paternal genetic effects. There has been much less work on paternal genetic effects than there has been on maternal genetic effects that I'm aware of. But I'm sure that indeed some work has been gone on there. But certainly in those species like mammals, where it's the mother that obviously bears the young in utero, we would expect maternal effects to be, and maternal environment effects to probably be, or to be stronger than any paternal genetic effects for most traits that we look at. I suspect that's the case. However, obviously in other species where parental care is a little bit different, and males can actually contribute substantially to raising offspring, things like seahorses would be a good case mm-hmm. to look, one might expect to see very strong paternal effects.
Right, so depending on how who is carrying the burden of that gestation.
The developing young, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
There has been some evidence of paternal effects. the Pembry study of this strange village in Sweden, that had taken records in the 19th century over 150 years and took very meticulous records of levels of amount of food that they had to eat in this village and the death reasons and death rates of its people, and they found that there's correlations between famine, times of famine, and the grandfathers, when the grandfathers are just pre-puberty, mm-hmm. right? And later medical effects, diseases in their grandchildren. So that if you were the young man who had living in a time of famine, your grandchild would be more likely to get diabetes, perhaps, would have less of a chance of, I think it was, heart attacks. But if you were living in a time of feast, they would have a higher risk of diabetes.
Right.
And it was correlated pretty well because they had very good records over hundreds of years in an area where diet wasn't a factor, where they were eating the same poor, awful,
the same pickled fish, whatever they ate. Yeah. So I wasn't aware of that study, but that makes good sense. As I say, there's nothing to rule them out. It's just I think more focus has been invested in trying to identify maternal effects.
Right, which is interesting. I think that's the bias, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, who's in charge of rearing the young in humans, and so we're going to go toward maternal effects, whereas, you know...
Right, it's also, I think, easier to track because maternal effects are going to happen while pregnant, and then you know that's the time to be watching. Mm-hmm. The paternal effects from the Marcus Pembry study
skipping generations.
Generations, but it was also in a weird spot because the area in which the effects were taking place on the fathers was when they were just going into that stage of pre-puberty.
Yeah.
So it was a very odd time to really be tracking ahead of to watch for a future generation versus...
Yeah, and I think
if you've got somebody pregnant, it's easier to know that it's time to pay attention. Or maybe a little too late.
And this kind of this definitely gets into that area of epigenetics and what are the controls that are possibly getting, you know, what are the changes that are happening during someone's lifetime that could potentially affect what genes are turned on or off
right.
down the road in your offspring or your offspring's offspring.
Absolutely.
I'm just
that's an area of burgeoning research at the moment. You know, we still have a huge amount to learn in that area, but you're absolutely right that it appears that all sorts of genes can be turned on and off as a function of behavior in the environment you experience. And there's been some quite nice research in mice, for example, that show cross-generational effects of the amount of grooming that, say, individuals have when they were young. That appears to then influence gene expression in themselves, and then passing on phenotypic consequences to their offspring.
Wow!
So absolutely, there are these epigenetic effects of different genes being turned on as a function of all sorts of aspects of your environment. But as I say, it's an emerging area. It's a very exciting area, and over the coming years, I'm sure we're going to hear many more exciting stories, and as we gain insight into how these effects actually occur.
Yeah. Someone on Twitter, I'm looking at the Twitter feed right now, Mike Chelin is asking what fruit fly eye color study you were referring to and what that had to do with the conversation. No, that I added that.
You added that. Oh, that. Oh, nice. I'll have to look it up. But
I'm
it was.
Giving, I'm just giving you a hard time. What else is new?
I pulled that off of the NOVA website. So if you go to NOVA's website and look at the epigenetics, it'll be able to link you over to that one. I don't have it right in front of me here, but it was an interesting study because it was white-eyed fruit flies that they'd incubated at a different temperature, I believe, and it resulted in a red eye. But what was more interesting is that the successive generations of breeding with that fly also had the red eye tint to them. So it wasn't just something that had affected that one generation, and it was a multi-generational thing. And it actually ended up being removed, I think, after successive generations, like five generations or something, the red sort of went away again, which is also interesting. But I think...
Fascinating.
Yeah. I would make my Galapagos Islands, I would make that the Arctic. I think there's something... I think we could find at least one of these effects of the environment... of hormones, certainly, and epigenetics taking place, and the fact that there's so many white animals in the Arctic. And I know, and it's one that every time I've brought this up, people go, no, that's the most obvious example of natural selection. All the white ones survived. But I think if you look at the Arctic, which is a very lonely, very non-competitive place, you can walk for days and not see a soul. And then you look at the foxes, who with less stress, hormones, had less pigment being put into their fur. You could sort of see where any animals that had wandered out and were making a living in the Arctic were having probably a less stressful time. They weren't probably worried about being devoured, at least the young probably weren't worried about being devoured, or the mothers weren't worried about being devoured. So that with less stress, you can end up with a lighter fur, and then... because that's the pool you have, these lighter furred animals, the natural selection starts taking over to where, yeah, the very lighter ones perhaps are having better odds at survival. Maybe. But overall, the thing that gets the things moving, because I don't think I've argued against natural selection at any point.
No, you haven't.
But I would argue against random mutation. I think that unless I'm missing the definition, I don't mean intentional. I don't think there's an intentional mutation. But I'm saying there's a reason for the mutation, right? It's not, we don't,
there's a mechanism. I was going to answer that, but I'll let Dr. Coulson, the expert, answer that point.
Well, so, again, there's quite a lot of work being done on what causes mutation and whether there are some areas of the genome where mutations occur a little bit more frequently or less frequently than other areas, as well as research on DNA or DNA repair enzymes. So there are enzymes out there that have been selected that will go along and check your DNA and will repair it. And they seem to be a little bit more prevalent in some parts of the genome than in other parts. Now, my understanding is that mutations, whether a mutation occurs at a specific point or not, is random. It's just a chance event. It's something, something that goes wrong in terms of the DNA there. However, I do think there's mounting evidence that mutation rates do actually increase when stress or environmental stress increases. And that may be because less resources are put towards DNA repair mechanisms. So, i.e., the DNA is not being repaired as fast as it used to under good conditions. It may mean there are more antioxidants out there that increase mutation rates. So I think mutation rates can certainly vary as a function of the environment that an individual finds itself in. But I think the positioning of each mutation is essentially random, although there are areas in the genome where mutations do occur at a higher rate than elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So that's my understanding, although I have to say I haven't researched myself mutation rates in a huge amount of detail.
Right. And then getting into the point that Justin was making about the possible hormonal effects leading to the change in coat color that allowed certain individuals to survive better in the Arctic. Do you think that that kind of a, I guess, evolutionary mechanism could have been in place?
That strikes me as, I don't think that would be my first hypothesis. It strikes me as probably quite a slightly labored argument. I think I suspect that the Arctic's a pretty stressful place. You know, there's not a huge amount of food there. It's cold. You know, life is at, certainly vertebrate life, is at relatively low densities. So it's probably quite hard to find something to eat. I don't think I'd probably think about moving up to the Arctic for a nice, easy, stress-free existence.
You'd have to get used to mouse meat and narwhal, which is actually surprisingly good.
I have to take your word for it. But of course, it's perhaps that's absolutely spot on, and that's the way it's working. But I suspect that wouldn't be the first hypothesis I'd go out and try and test.
I'll take perhaps spot on. That sounds.
That's nice. So thinking about the idea of epigenetics more, do you think that they're, you know, in the growth rates, I mean, can you imagine or postulate any places where epigenetics might be impacting your shrinking sheep, that might, you know, the climate change effects might be leading, you know, through epigenetics somehow to this change?
It's entirely possible. What we've really been able to say so far is that we have seen a decline in both in growth rates, and through our statistical analyses of that decline in growth rates, we've found that we've been able to explain a reasonable amount of variation with climatic drivers and what have you. There are, you know, actually pinning down, and this appears to be driven primarily through the shortening winters and more individuals surviving. As I said before, there may be all sorts of other factors out there that we haven't measured, and some of them could well be epigenetic factors. Some of them may be purely environmental as well. And you know, I'm not going to speculate on what other processes might be operating. You know, it could be, as we discussed earlier, it could be changes in the levels of plant secondary compounds. There are, you know, potentially many other factors that one could try and bring in here. Certainly, whatever the process that's going on, it does appear to be driven, or whatever the mechanisms are that have led to, the changes we've observed, it does appear to be the case, and, you know, this is what we are, you know, I'm happy to state, it does appear to be the case that it is the changing climate that's causing changes in the growth rates, and the fact that smaller sheep are now surviving better than they used to. Exactly what the mechanism is that's causing that, we haven't been able to pin down, but hopefully in future work we'll be able to get there.
And then hopefully we can recreate the effect in people. Because if there was just smaller people everywhere, again, we'd have more resources to go around.
Yeah. But then we might end up with even more people. I don't know. You know, that, as you asked me before about the food per sheep, and I suspect the food per kilogram per sheep is remained about constant. The problem, of course, that we've got is we're just eating more and more and getting bigger and bigger. Well, that's what I hear is going on in California anyway.
Oh, my goodness. All we need is one earthquake, and it's like a reset button. It's like...
I'm not prepared to go down that one.
No, the freeways are full of people, like, getting the heck out of this. What? The earth moves? Really? It's like that? I heard about it. I thought it was a myth.
Back to the Midwest.
Back to the Midwest. Back to the East Coast they go.
Oh, we're getting towards the end of our show. This has been so fabulous. I had, I guess, one final question from, you know, the perspective of a population biologist, a life scientist studying evolutionary processes. There's a question that's been posed by the John Templeton Foundation in the name of Darwin's year of birth and the origin of species anniversary, and also this year of science. Does evolution explain human nature? Do you have an opinion on that?
It must certainly contribute. There's no doubt about that. And again, there's a lot of work by human evolutionary biologists investigating this. Again, I'm not an expert on this, but I'd be absolutely staggered if evolution didn't play a role, and I would suspect that role is relatively important.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Not a particularly good answer.
Well, the thing that
you're
actually
hedging a little. That's all right.
And this is back to
on,
like,
you got me on an air. I don't really know very much about that.
You don't know about human nature? What planet are you from? No.
The thing that keeps coming to mind is the chicken and the egg. And it's like such a, like one of the oldest, silliest things to talk about in evolution. But a lot of this does sound like that to me. I mean, whether it was our genes or whether it was our selection that created our human behavior, or if our human behavior drove our genes in the direction, or if it's epigenetic creating the change but natural selection propagating it, or if it's the other way around, it's which came first. And I guess what it is we got to stop worrying about the hierarchy of it. There isn't necessarily one that came really before the other.
Right. It's probably a very complex interactive web.
I'm sure that's right. Basically, remember that, again, it's all boiling down to that map between the genes and the phenotype and kind of how they feed back on one another, mm-hmm. and then how selection is operating on the phenotype and changing the underlying genes. It just goes on and on and on.
I prefer linear. Linear, just put it in one line. This, like, you
A,
know,
B,
the,
C,
the
make
guy,
it easy.
The ape, and then he morphed into the guy with the briefcase. You know, the lineup there?
Oh, I'm glad it's not that simple, otherwise I'd be out of a job.
Oh, well, there we go. For your sake, I hope it doesn't get simplified then.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's been fabulous speaking with you. Thank you for your opinion.
Your refereeing.
Not at all. It's been all my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. And I look forward to hearing much more about the Scottish sheep. And, you know, I know that you've got, what is it, Slapped? Is the
what?
Isn't that what it slapped? It's your research group looking
yes,
at.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's a slightly tortured acronym that one of my postdocs came up with. But
right. So you're looking.
It kind of stuck.
you're looking not just at Scottish sheep. You're looking at animals all over the place, and so
we have projects all over the world. Yeah, absolutely.
Great. So I look forward to hearing much more about your work and the work that you're doing with others. Good luck, and we'll speak with you sometimes in the future, I hope.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye, Dr. Coulson.
Bye.
Yes, that was Dr. Tim Coulson from the Imperial College London, not university. I just got that one wrong. Next week, we will be talking with
sometime in the future.
No, we're going to be talking with our favorite science and politics author, Chris Mooney.
Yay!
Yay! He wrote The Republican War on Science. He wrote about hurricanes. Can't remember the name of his book. But he's back with another book, and it's all about the unscientific America.
Oh.
Yeah, so it'll be very interesting to talk with him about the way that Americans perceive science, and also, you know, the schism between the intelligentsia and the public. Ah!
Intelligentsia. And you know what? You should write into us with your opinion on that ahead of that show. So we'll have some of that, those kind of questions or comments or observations that you've made about how science is being treated in the news or in your community or anything like that.
Yeah, we'd love that. So you can email us at Kirsten@ThisWeekInScience or Justin@ThisWeekInScience.com.
Put twist somewhere in the subject, otherwise it goes right to our very intensive spam filter, which filters out everything that doesn't have twist somewhere in the subject line.
Yeah. You can also go to the forums on our website. Our website is twist.org, and additionally there are show notes with links to stories that we discuss during the show. This week there's only one show. Well, I mean one story. So.
And you can always hit us in the middle of the week, in the middle of the night even, if it so hits you, strikes you, at JacksonFly or Dr. Kiki on the Twitter.
On the Twitter. And we thank you so much for listening this week. We hope you enjoyed our special hour-long show on evolution and all the nuts and bolts that go on. There's much more to it than what we got to, you know. People spend years talking about this subject, and we just spent an hour. But it was lots of fun. It was very enjoyable. We will be back here on KDVS next Tuesday at 8:30 a.m. Pacific Time. We hope that you will join us again for more great science news.
And if you've learned anything from today's show, remember,
it's all in your head.
This week in science. This week in science. This week in science.
This Week in Science, it's the end of the world. So I'm setting up shop, got my banner unfurled. It says the scientist is in, I'm gonna sell my advice. Show them how to stop the robots with a simple device. I'll reverse global warming with a wave of my hand. And all it'll cost you is a couple of grand. This Week Science is coming your way. So everybody listen to what I say. I use the scientific method for all that it's worth, and I'll broadcast my opinion all over the earth. Cause it's This Week in Science.
This Week in Science.
This Week in Science. 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 This Week in Science.
This Week in Science.
This Week in Science, science, science. I've got one disclaimer, and it shouldn't be news, that what I say may not represent your views. But I've done the calculations, and I've got a plan. If you listen to the science, you may just yet understand that we're not trying to threaten your philosophy. We're just trying to save the world from jeopardy.
Jeopardy.
And This Week in Science is coming your way. Everybody listen to everything we say. And if you use our method instead of rolling a die, we may rid the world of toxoplasma gandhii. Aye, 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 aye. Cause it's This Week in Science.
This Week in Science.
This Week in Science. Science, science.
This Week in Science.
This Week in Science. Science, science. I've got a laundry list of items I want to address, from stopping global hunger to dredging Loch Ness. I'm trying to promote more rational thought, and I'll try to answer any question you've got. But how can I ever see the changes I seek when I can only set up shop 1 hour a week?
This is WHFR, Dearborn, the station making waves. I'm Jay Koronick, station advisor. Today's WHFR forum, by special arrangement, is the July 7th edition of This Week in Science, a weekly talk news show produced by and broadcast on KDVS-FM at the University of California, Davis. The creator host is Dr. Kirsten Sanford, and her co-host is Justin Jackson. The topic of this show is evolution, and their special guest is Dr. Tim Coulson of the Imperial College, London. If you like This Week in Science and would like to hear each of their shows regularly on WHFR, please let us know by sending